The subject that we're going to be discussing today is PVL Staphylococcus aureus, a Panton Valentine leukocidin producing Staph aureus that's causing us a few problems in the UK, and particularly in the southwest of the region. You'll see from the PowerPoint that's been put on the website that we were expecting two speakers today, and unfortunately Brenda Dale isn't able to be with us today. We hope she'll be listening in, but she hasn't been well. But we have Adam Brown, who is a consultant medical microbiologist with great experience of PVL, as he was down here in Derriford, which is down in Devon, when we were having these problems. He qualified in Barts 1997, and after various junior doctor posts, he settled in Devon and trained as a medical microbiologist, where he tells me he encountered a plague of boils. I'm sure he'll tell us more about that directly. Since February, he's been a consultant medical microbiologist at Doncaster and Bassett Law Hospitals Foundation NHS Trust in South Yorkshire. So he's up there with the gods. I believe Yorkshire's supposed to be the land of the gods, but we would argue with that in Cornwall. So can I please welcome all of you to the teleclass and to pass over to Adam, who's going to do the whole presentation for us on PVL Staph aureus. Over to you, Adam. Thank you.
As been mentioned, Brenda is unable to talk today. I will do my best to present her bits, but I'm not an expert in infection control as she is, but I shall do my best. So if we move on to slide two, this is a cutting from a local tabloid newspaper in the UK. We're all aware of the problems with MRSA and how the press like to call it the flesh-eating superbug virus and other interesting things. But since MRSA has been at the forefront, they've now found a new superbug that they like to talk about. And if we move on to slide three, this is the headline from the Daily Express, which is another UK newspaper, a new bug that kills in hours. It's a suitably tabloid-type headline. But it's all to do with the infection that is mentioned in slide four. And this is a young chap who was a Royal Marine at Lympston Commando Centre in Devon, which is a Royal Marine training camp. And he died of Staph aureus infection, and he died very, very quickly. And it was found that he had a PVL-producing Staph aureus. And this chap was extremely fit and healthy. He was a natural athlete, but he still managed to die within 24 hours of getting an infection. So it's very much in the forefront of people's minds, certainly in the UK and certainly in America, and to some extent in Canada as well. And so this presentation is really just to discuss what PVL is, what it does, and why it's so nasty. So if we move on to slide five, this is just an overview of what I shall talk about. So, as I say, I'll talk about PVL and how it works. I'll talk a little bit about the unusual situation that we have in the southwest of England, in Devon and Cornwall, and how we've managed this in that area and how that relates to the wider world. And then we'll talk a little bit about MRSA and its links with PVL, and then see if there's any questions after that, if we have time. So if we move on to slide six, PVL is a toxin that's produced by Staph aureus. And to understand what PVL does, we need to go right back to the fundamentals of how bacteria cause infection. Bacteria can cause infection and can enter hosts by means of virulence factors. And these are products that enable a bug to establish itself on or within a host and enhance its potential to cause disease. And virulence factors include things like binding proteins that allow the bacteria to bind to their hosts, and also also includes toxins. Most bacteria that cause infection will produce toxins, and Staph aureus has a whole range that it can produce. So if we move on to slide seven, so as I say, staphylococci can produce toxins. And these toxins help to modulate pathogenicity, and they do that in a wide range of different ways. They produce several different types of toxins, there are the enterotoxins, which are produced by certain staphylococci, which can cause food poisoning. So people who've eaten food that's been contaminated with Staph aureus that produces enterotoxins, you can get quite nasty diarrhea and vomiting from it. There's also toxic shock syndrome toxin, or TSST, and that produces the classical picture of toxic shock syndrome, which is associated with use of tampons. And this can be quite a sort of fulminant shock that you can get with an infection, with low blood pressure, and it can be rapidly fatal. There are other toxins which are almost ubiquitously produced by Staph aureus, and these are in the hemolysin group of toxins. And these basically help the bug to break down cells and to break down tissue so that they can feed off the host. And probably about 99% of all Staph aureus isolates will produce hemolysins. And then there's the one that we're interested in today, and that's PVL, or Pantone Valentine Leukocidin. And that's a toxin that's produced by a smaller number of staphylococci, and it's toxic to leukocytes, toxic to white cells. So if we move on to slide 8, just a quick overview of Pantone Valentine Leukocidin. It's what's called a synergohymenotrophic toxin. And basically that means that it's made up of two subunits, which work in synergy, hence the synergo bit. Hymenotrophic means that it sticks to walls of tissues, so it will stick to skin and stick to endothelium and epithelium. So that's the hymenotrophic bit. It's closely related to the hemolysin toxins, which I mentioned, produced by most strains of Staph aureus. It's very similar in its structure, very similar in its action, but it's more toxic against white cells rather than red cells. So whilst the hemolysins are produced by about 100% of all strains, PVL is produced by roughly 2 to 5% of all strains that we encounter. There's been some work done by Angela Kearns, who is the head of the Staphylococcal Reference Laboratory in the UK, and she's recently published some figures which put it at around 2%. The toxin, as I say, is made up of two subunits, so it's a bicomponent toxin. Because it's so similar to gamma hemolysin, it can share these subunits, and it can mix and match between the gamma hemolysin subunits and the PVL subunits. So you get these sort of hybrid, sort of mongrel toxins produced. If you move on to slide 9, this is just a quick table just to show the different subunits. So there are two subunits, class F subunits and class S subunits. The PVL subunits are called LUC-F and LUC-S, and together they produce PVL. If gamma hemolysin can produce one class F subunit called HLGB, or two class S subunits called A and C, and together HGLB and C, or HGLB and A, will produce gamma hemolysin. But you can get this mixture with the leukocidin subunits. And so you get this spectrum where pure gamma hemolysin is pretty much hemolytic and nothing else. And PVL, the pure PVL, is pretty much leukotoxic, but doesn't break down white red cells, and then the rest is somewhere in between. So you can get this spectrum of tissue damage. So if we move on to slide 10, we've talked about the theory behind PVL, but what does it actually do? Well, it kills polymorphs and macrophages, so it kills white cells, breaks down white cells, but it also causes tissue necrosis, and this is because it binds to epithelium, and then can break down the tissues therein. So it can cause skin necrosis and lung necrosis, and also surrounding soft tissue necrosis as well. As I said, around 2 to 5% of all isolates will produce PVL. But if you break those isolates down by the type of infection that you take them from, you find a very different picture. So there's a very strong association with suppurative skin infections, such as furunculosis, where 93% of all isolates will be PVL positive. Cellulitis, again, there's a positive correlation between cellulitis and PVL production. And further on, abscesses and things like that as well. There was a paper in Clinical Infectious Diseases from 1999 which outlines this very well, and the reference is there in the bottom left of that slide. So if we move on to slide 11. So we've talked about the soft tissue infections that it can cause, the skin infections, furunculosis, cellulitis, things like this. It can also cause fulminant infection, rapidly fatal infection in many cases. And this is usually due to invasion of the lungs. So you can get severe necrotic hemorrhagic pneumonia. Now, interestingly, this is usually community acquired, and it usually seems to attack the young, fit and healthy, and it has a very high mortality, currently around 75%, although some papers have shown that some areas have had a lower mortality than that. And it's not the actual Staph aureus itself that does the damage, it's the toxin that it produces, so it's the PVL toxin that it produces which does the damage to the lungs. Why does it attack the usually young and fit? Well, it's possible that this is the case because those people haven't been exposed to Staph aureus in the past, so their immune systems are relatively naive when it comes to Staph aureus, and so any infection that they get with Staph aureus can be more severe. But it's all conjecture and theory, really, at the moment. If we move on to slide 12, this is just to outline the clinical implications of staphylococcal infection with PVL-producing strains, as mentioned in the literature. The Lancet in 2002 mentioned a group of cases of community-acquired pneumonia due to this PVL-producing Staph aureus. And of those 8 cases, 6 were fatal, and all were in young, healthy children and adults. There was a paper in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology in 2001, which was a case report of a young child, an infant, who had been breastfed, and the mother had furunculosis, and she had a boil on her breast. And the baby developed periorbital cellulitis, which then spread and became a pneumonia. And amazingly, the baby actually survived, although the baby did have to have a partial lung resection to remove infected tissue. If we move on to slide 13, I'd like to just talk to you about my own experience with PVL pneumonia and mention a case study that that we had in Devon. This is at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital, which is in East Devon. This was a lady, she was 30 years old, previously fit and well. She worked in a nursing home as a hairdresser, but the nursing home had no other cases of staphylococcal infection that we could identify. She was admitted after a short history of flu-like symptoms, so she had fevers, achy joints, backache, just generally feeling run down. But when she was admitted to A&E, she was in extremis. She had a rapid onset, very high temperature. She was hypoxic and she was looking shocked. She was coughing up frank blood and she was tachycardic and she was short of breath. And when some blood tests were done in the resuscitation room in A&E, she was found to have a very high C-reactive protein, which is indicative of infection or inflammation. And she also had a very low white cell count. Usually with infection, you'd expect to see a high white cell count. Now, those signs and symptoms that are coloured in orange are very important when thinking about PVL-producing staphylococcal infection, because they're the sort of things that you'll get with a PVL pneumonia. If we move on to the next slide, which is slide 14, this is her chest x-ray. And as you can see, I don't know how well it shows up on the handouts, but on screen you can see that there is diffuse shadowing throughout both lung fields. Certainly the right lung is almost a complete whiteout in all zones of the lung. And the left lung in the lower zone, there's extensive consolidation. If we move on to slide 15, this is the sputum that she was bringing up. So when we talk about hemoptysis, we often think about a few spits and spots of blood in sputum, but this is proper hemoptysis where most of the sputum was blood. We looked at her sputum under a microscope, and slide 16 shows a gram stain of her sputum. Now, in people with purulent sputum, you'd expect to see lots and lots of white cells, and they're the big red blobs that you can see on that slide, or the big, slightly lighter grey blobs on a handout. There aren't as many white cells there as you'd expect from somebody with purulent sputum with a chest infection. The small dark purple or black circles are staphylococci. That's Staphylococcus aureus. And that number that you see there is quite a large number. There are vast quantities of staphylococci in this woman's sputum. If we move on to slide 17, we incubated and cultured the sputum in the laboratory, and we grew Staphylococcus aureus. Blood cultures have been taken on admission from this lady, and they also grew Staphylococcus aureus. By this time, she was so unwell that she was admitted to intensive care and was supported with a ventilator. We gave her large quantities of antibiotics because we were suspecting that she had a PVL-producing pneumonia. She certainly had a staphylococcal pneumonia and was very unwell. So we gave her large amounts of antibiotics, including flucloxacillin and clindamycin. Now, flucloxacillin is very effective against most isolates of Staph aureus, and clindamycin is also a very good antibiotic for getting into soft tissues such as the lungs, and is very effective against Staph aureus. It also has the added benefit of being able to switch off toxin production, which in somebody with a PVL-producing Staph aureus pneumonia is very important. We enlisted the help of various experts around Europe, including Didier Raoul, who is the French expert in PVL, and he gave his expert opinion as well and said that we were doing all the right things. We also gave her immunoglobulin in large doses. Now, this is something that we give to people with group A strep toxic shock, can help to help the body fight the effects of toxins. And we had nothing to lose in this lady. She was very, very unwell, so we gave her immunoglobulins as well. And as I say, she was in intensive care and was receiving all the supportive therapy there, so ventilation, inotropes to maintain her blood pressure, fluid resuscitation, etc. Slide 18 shows her observation chart. So at the bottom is her blood pressure and pulse, and the top line is her temperature, and the thick line is 37 degrees. So that's the normal temperature that we're aiming for. And as you can see, for the first period of time, her temperature was very high, peaked at 40 degrees. The big arrowhead is where we introduced the antibiotics. As you can see, her temperature started to drop quite rapidly. And within a few hours, her temperature had returned to 37 degrees or lower. And we thought that we were doing very well. So if we move on to slide 19, after the commencement of antibiotics, she was apyrexial. And within 24 hours of starting the antibiotics, we weren't able to grow Staph aureus from anywhere. So the antibiotics were obviously doing their job. We couldn't grow it in the sputum or in her blood, and she was stabilized. Her blood pressure returned to normal and her pulse returned to normal, and we were very hopeful of the outcome. But as the next few days went on, she deteriorated. She became harder to ventilate. She needed increasing pressures to ventilate, and subsequent x-rays showed that there were cavitating lesions in the lung. And sadly, she died. We were unable to ventilate her. For those of you who have just had your lunch, probably best to look away at the next slide 20, which shows a post-mortem sample from this lady. But for those of you who haven't or have a strong constitution, if we move on to slide 20, I don't know how well it shows up on the on your projectors and in the handout, but this is a post-mortem sample of this lady's lung. And usually lung is a sort of nice tan colour and is of a uniform consistency. This lady's lung was full of fluid, very bloody fluid, and there were large necrotic areas. If you put a gloved finger onto the surface of the cut surface of the lung, bits of lung would actually come off. So her lungs were actually had actually started to disintegrate, and there were large necrotic areas. So that was one case of a PVL Staph aureus pneumonia. If we move on to slide 21, I'll just talk about a cluster of infections that we've had. Now, I can't talk about this cluster too much because it's at a marine camp, so it's all under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Defence. But what I can say is that this marine camp has had a problem with a sensitive strain of Staph aureus, which has been proven to be a PVL producer. and they've had lots of cases of soft tissue infection. So we're talking where they've been out on manoeuvres and they're running through prickles and gorse and things like this, and they've got scratches, and where they've been out doing 30-kilometre runs and things like this in their full gear, and they've got webbing burns where their clothes are rubbed against their skin, or where they've got blisters on their feet. We're getting lots of cases of cellulitis and soft tissue infection. We have had the one fatality which was mentioned right at the start, which was the chap that was in the paper. Steps are underway to control this and to prevent this, but as I say, I can't really talk about that too much because it's out of my jurisdiction. But if we move on to slide 22, this is something I can talk a little bit more about. This is a cluster which is now a very, very large cluster of Staphylococcus isolates found in and around the city of Plymouth, which is in southwest Devon in the UK. It's unusual in that the outbreaks of the cases of Staph aureus infection that we've seen are multi-resistant, although they're not resistant to methicillin. They're not resistant to methicillin, so they're not MRSA, but they are resistant to some other antibiotics such as gentamicin and trimethoprim. And it was that helped us pick these out, because they stick out like a sore thumb from the usual strains of Staph aureus that we encounter. And we were finding that we were getting lots of cases of boils from all across the city of Plymouth. And our first case that we noticed was in April 1997. And I've got data up until November 2004, although ongoing data collection has been taking place right up to the present. And we're seeing an awful lot of cases of this Staph aureus. So if we move on to slide 23, just to describe this a little bit further, between 1997 and November 2004, we had isolates from 315 patients. Some of these patients had multiple isolates spreading over that full seven-year period. So it's something that is very difficult to get rid of. The age range was from 2 days to 99 years. The vast majority of these isolates were from general practitioners or family doctors within in the community. So 134 of those 315 were from GPs. The remainder were from the surgical assessment unit and from accident and emergency. So they were people who had been admitted to hospital with these infections. Although we did have a very small number from the surgical wards, but again, we think that they came in with infections. And if we move on to slide 24, just to describe the infections we were getting, the vast majority were boils and abscesses. And this strain of Staph aureus likes to infect damp, sweaty places. So we're finding a lot of boils and abscesses in armpits and on buttocks and in groins. We did have 10 isolates from sputum, and interestingly, 5 of those isolates from sputum were from people with cystic fibrosis. Now, these are sort of people who you'd expect that if they were to get a nasty bug like this, that they'd be very unwell. But actually, for some reason, the cystic fibrosis patients managed to tolerate this within their lungs quite well. And the theory is that maybe another bug, such as Pseudomonas, that was in their lungs was helping to switch off the PVL toxin production. We did have 4 cases of pneumonia, of which 3 were fatal. And unusually, as we're all in the elderly rather than in the young, healthy people, which PVL pneumonia is meant to affect. And we did have one outbreak within the hospital in Derriford Hospital in Plymouth. And this was an outbreak of mastitis. And these were really quite nasty cases of mastitis. We had one lady who had a 20-centimetre breast abscess, which needed surgical intervention. We didn't manage to find the index case, and we didn't manage to find, despite extensive environmental screening, any evidence of the PVL bug in the environment. And it's thought that this was brought in by one of the people who was infected within the outbreak, but we're not sure which one. But that's they're the only hospital-acquired cases that we've had. So if we move on to slide 25. Now, as I say, most of these isolates were from the community. Interestingly, a large quantity of those community isolates were from nursing homes. And there are probably about 30 to 40 nursing homes in the Plymouth area. And we've isolated PVL from around 27 different nursing homes in the period between 1997 and 2004. Subsequently, there have been further outbreaks. Our first outbreak was in September 1997, and we've had 10 nursing homes with more than two or more cases of PVL, Staph aureus infection. And of those 10, only two of them were notified to us as an outbreak. If we move on to slide 26, this graph basically just tries to show the different nursing homes. So along the vertical column, we've got numbers of outbreaks from each nursing home. And along the bottom column, we have an arbitrary number assigned to each nursing home. So each of those bars represents a single nursing home. And as you can see, there are 4 nursing homes which have had 5 or more cases, and 3 of those have had 10 or more cases. The bars that are darker were the two that were notified to us as an outbreak. And if we move on to slide 27, this is just that same data shown in a different format. So the vertical column lists those 27 arbitrarily numbered nursing homes, and the horizontal line shows a timeline, so that's the date along the bottom. And you can see that as you look along the horizontal lines, you can see where there have been clusters of these infections from the various nursing homes. And the ones that are marked with a dotted bar are ones that we've identified as an outbreak subsequently. And the two that are marked with a solid lined bar, they're the two that were told to us as an outbreak by the nursing homes themselves. If we move on to slide 28, I'm now going to try and pretend to be Brenda Dale, who, as has been mentioned, is unable to speak today. I will do my best to go through her slides, but as I say, I'm not a health protection nurse, and I don't have her expertise in this area, but I will do my best. If there are any questions at the end of this, then please feel free to email me, and I can always pass them on to Brenda for clarification if need be. So Brenda was going to talk about outbreaks in care homes within the Plymouth area and the public health and infection control implications of those outbreaks. And she was going to describe 4 outbreaks that we've had, one of which is in a home that's been treated twice. And she's going to talk about the state of hygiene and infection control measures within those nursing homes, and give advice about how that can be improved, how these infections can be managed from an infection control point of view, and how they were treated. And also then just to discuss briefly the sort of multidisciplinary approach, so liaison with microbiologists such as myself and with the primary care trusts who run community medicine within the UK, and also with general practitioners or family practitioners. And then briefly to touch on the national guidance which is emerging. So if we move on to slide 30, outbreak 1 is a care home that was, this outbreak was identified in 2003-2004, and mass treatment was instigated for all of the people within the nursing home. Basically, there were several cases of boils. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was over 10 or 15 cases of boils. And so everybody within the nursing home was swabbed, screened, and treated. And the treatment for the boils, we used flucloxacillin. And then decolonization for anybody who was just colonized, or the people who've been successfully treated with antibiotics. We use the same sort of methods as we would for MRSA, so antibacterial body washes, nasal mupirocin, etc. And any people who've been positive from the initial screening was re-swabbed, and any people who were subsequently positive had a subsequent course of decolonization. The swabbing was done by the nursing home staff themselves, and this is no mean feat for a nursing home that's busy and whose staff have other things that they have to do. So they did very well. If we move on to slide 31, this is just an outline of the second outbreak that we identified. This is in a residential home in September 2005. There's one death in this situation from PVL pneumonia. And it was that death from PVL pneumonia that brought this nursing home to our attention. and subsequent inquiries by the health protection nurses within the health protection agency revealed that the nursing home had several cases of boils. So the health protection unit nurses went in and they swabbed over 90 people. So that's not just patients, but also nursing home staff as well. And mass decolonisation treatment was again implicated. So that again was topical decolonisation with antibacterial body washes and nasal mupirocin. And those who were still colonised were retreated. The problem with this residential home these were EMI patients, so the compliance was very difficult, and these people are often moving around from one room to another and socialising with each other, and it's very difficult to maintain good infection control practice. But fingers crossed, things have been fine since the mass decolonisation. There have been no further cases to date. We move on to slide 32. Outbreak 3 was in a care home in January 2006. It was the same care home that Outbreak 1 had been implicated in. There were further cases, and one staff member and two patients were confirmed to have PVL colonisation. They were decolonised and treated. Now, by this point, this nursing home was very much on the ball, and the matron running the nursing home was very much on the ball. And was very, very keen to make sure that best infection control practice was followed. And so it was only we were able to target just the staff members and the patients who confirmed to be colonised with decolonisation and treatment, which reduced the workload for the nursing home quite considerably. And after all treatment, re-swabbing showed that there was no further PVL found. So hopefully that's been eradicated in this instance. And then slide 33, outbreak 4 is a nursing stroke residential home. And they had a two-year history of boils and abscesses, recurrent boils and abscesses in both staff and patients. And this had been recognised by the district nurses and brought to the health protection unit's attention. It's possible that one of the members of staff could have been linked with the outbreak of mastitis that I mentioned earlier on within Derriford Hospital. This is conjecture at the moment, but she had been on the ward that had been infected at around the same period of time, so it's certainly possible. We instigated mass decolonisation again and then screened, and at the time of writing, this was in progress and the results were awaited, but I believe that things are going in the right direction. Moving on to slide 34, just discussing how the advice that we can give to the nursing homes. It's important that we give information regarding the organism itself. So there's no point in us just telling people, you've got a Staph aureus. We need to say that they have a PVL-producing Staph aureus. We need to tell them what the implications of that are, what PVL does, how it manifests itself, and that it is an infection control risk, much in the same way that MRSA is. We need to discuss with them transmission, how the bug is transmitted. And this is like any other Staph aureus, so it's hand-to-hand contact with contaminated surfaces and materials, etc. And if somebody has a PVL pneumonia, then contact with respiratory secretions as well. We need to discuss cleaning and linen and also equipment, so these are all hygiene issues. Cleaning, we recommended that all of these places were deep cleaned, so all surfaces were cleaned. Any linen was washed and changed on a daily basis while during there was an outbreak, and any equipment was ensured to be scrupulously clean. Moving on to slide 35. And moving out of the nursing homes and into the community, we found that there are several families that have been affected by PVL-producing Staph aureus. So it does seem to pass from one family member to another. And we've had some families that have had recurrent boils for 2 or 3 years, if not more. And this has been a terrible problem for both the parents and children as well. And a lot of these boils have had to require surgical drainage, which has been really traumatic for the children, and multiple courses of antibiotics, mainly flucloxacillin. And so we've tried to liaise as closely as possible with the families and provide as much support as possible. And the Health Protection Unit is trying to secure funding for a dedicated PVL nurse to deal with this within the community. And we give much the same information to these families as we do to the nursing homes. So we're giving information about changing bedding, about changing towels on a daily basis, about ensuring strict hand hygiene, cleaning surfaces and cleaning the environment that they live in, and making sure that they use the decolonisation therapy as instructed. Now, the families have been quite straightforward because it's just a few people in one house, but nursing homes are a slightly different matter. If we move on to slide 36, the issues with care homes, these are big places with often with 20, 30, 40 or more residents. They're often quite stretched staff-wise, and they often have a very poor standard of infection control because they don't work in the hospital environment, and they're not subject so much to the rigorous checks that hospitals and community hospitals are subject to from an infection control point of view. And often the staff aren't trained in recognising outbreaks, so they won't recognise the implications and importance of an outbreak of boils spreading over a period of months. If we move on to slide 37, this is an illustration of one of the rooms in one of the nursing homes that was implicated in the outbreaks. And as you can see, it's quite a difficult room to clean. It's not like a hospital ward or a hospital bay where you can wheel beds out and give everything a good wipe down and steam clean the curtains and things. These places, to make them suitable for people to live in for long periods of time, have to have all their personal effects, so bookshelves, tables, rugs, things like this. It makes it very difficult to clean these rooms effectively. If we move on to slide 38, that is a very unhappy-looking cat, and that was one of the cats that was at one of the nursing homes. It used to live in the nursing home, and the health protection nurses wondered whether this cat was implicated in the infection, so they tried to swab it. And it ran off and was never ever seen again since. So I don't know what happened to that poor cat. I'm moving on to slide 39. So issues for the health protection unit. What issues are facing the health protection unit within the Devon area? Obviously, PVL producing staph aureus is proving to be an increasing problem in the region. Certainly in the Devon area with our Plymouth strain and all these outbreaks within the nursing homes and the spontaneous cases in the community, but also it's becoming recognised across the UK as well. So we've tried to keep its profile up within the local medical and nursing community, and so there have been various articles in GP newsletters and public health newsletters, and we've sent information out to care homes as well. There has been some recent national guidance, and I'll go into that in further detail later. Which is welcome, but it is very much an interim set of guidelines at the moment. This has been produced by the Department of Health working group into PVL, and this working group was set up after the death of the Royal Marine that I mentioned right at the very start of this presentation. And the Regional Microbiology Forum, which is a forum for all of the microbiology consultants and infection control nurses, etc., to get together and discuss things, they have created a working group as well to try and preempt the national guidelines because we have a specific problem with this outbreak in Plymouth. But obviously, this outbreak and subsequent outbreaks have been a huge burden on resources, certainly on lab staff and the microbiologists. Through mass screening of patients, we've put a huge burden on the laboratories, and also on the health protection unit and the care homes through mass screening and treatment as well. Though, as mentioned earlier, some nursing homes were able to use targeted treatment in certain situations where the nursing homes are particularly switched onto the problem. And so it's very important that we maintain good education for these nursing homes, because then if they can recognise and maintain good infection control practice, then the need for mass treatment and screening is minimised. So that's basically what Brenda wanted to say. I hope I've done her justice. I'd like to move on to more depressing matters, if possible, by moving on to slide 40. And just to discuss what PVL has to do with MRSA. Now, obviously, MRSA in itself is a problem, both within hospitals and to a lesser extent within the community. But there have been isolates now of PVL-producing strains of MRSA. So you've got a double whammy now of MRSA and PVL-producing strains. Now, interestingly, these strains are almost exclusively found in the community. Throughout the whole world, wherever they're found, they're almost exclusively found in the community. And they're not actually related to the hospital strains of MRSA. So they're not MRSA that has escaped from the hospitals into the community and then picked up the PVL gene. These are separate phenomena. And they're on the increase. Initially, there were sporadic cases, which were seen as a bit of a medical curiosity across America, Canada, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and also down into Asia, Oceania, South America. So it's pretty much a global problem now. These sporadic cases have now become less and less sporadic and more commonly seen. And if we move on to slide 41, just to mention PVL-positive MRSA in the literature. There's a paper in CID, which is a Clinical Infectious Diseases journal, in 2005, which mentioned four patients which had PVL-positive MRSA pneumonia, and they were in younger people, so 20 to 52 years of age. Interestingly, they only had a 25% mortality rather than the 75% mortality, which is what people have tended to expect from these PVL pneumonias. And then there was a very interesting paper in the New England Journal of Medicine from 2005, which mentioned 14 cases of necrotizing PVL-associated community-acquired pneumonia that was due to PVL-producing MRSA in Los Angeles. And amazingly, they had no deaths. Again, they were in the younger population, and interestingly, they were in current or past IVDUs, or intravenous drug users. It's unsure what the significance of that is, but IVDUs are often subjected to staphylococcal infections due to injection. Moving on to slide 42, a couple more cases. In France in 2000, there were over 14 cases mentioned in that year alone, and there have also been cases in Germany and Norway. And then in Alaska, there were 34 cases of soft tissue infections in Alaskan steam rooms, and this was linked to damp wood within the saunas where people were sitting. The Staph aureus would be passed onto the wood, and then would live in the sweat and the grease from people in this nice warm environment. So it's a perfect incubating environment. Somebody else would sit down, and they'd get subsequent infection from the infected wood. And then if we move on to slide 43. Just further cases, just to outline, it's almost ubiquitous nature now. There have been cases in steam rooms in California. There have been cases of PVL-producing MRSA being found in causing soft tissue infections in San Francisco penitentiaries. That was back in 2001. And also in university athletes in Los Angeles, there have been cases of soft tissue infections as well. And that's probably because, you know, people are sharing towels and sharing changing rooms and their clothes are all getting mixed up and things. So if we move on to slide 44. So I mentioned that community-acquired MRSA, which incidentally produces PVL, is not the same lineage as hospital-acquired MRSA. Totally different. Now, most of you will be far too young to remember the 8081 strain of Staph aureus. And this was caused horrendous outbreaks of staphylococcal infection in the 1950s and 1960s within hospitals. Lots and lots of wound infections were being caused by this 8081 strain of Staph aureus. which was sensitive to flucloxacillin, but initially that wasn't available. But when methicillin and then its subsequent progeny Flu-Clox was introduced onto the market, the 8081 strain disappeared. Now, they found an isolate of 8081 strain in the back of a freezer somewhere, and they resurrected it and subsequently found that it is PVL positive. So that's why it was causing all these nasty wound infections in that period. And then moving on to slide 45, this is the family tree of MRSA. It's probable family tree. It's all conjecture, obviously. But at the very top of the family tree, the granddaddy of all the MRSAs that we see is ST30, which is just a strain of Staph aureus. It's just your bog standard wild type Staph aureus, resistant to penicillin but sensitive to flucloxacillin. On the right hand side of the family tree, we see hospital acquired MRSA. So the ST30 MRSA4, which is seen in the yellow box on the right, that is after. That's the original wild-type Staph aureus picked up the SCC MEC gene, which is the gene that gives you methicillin resistance, which turns a Staph aureus into MRSA. Then at some point it picked up another MEC gene and produced the hospital-acquired MRSAs that we see nowadays, these epidemic MRSAs such as the MRSA16. So that's your standard MRSA that we all know and love. On the left-hand side, we see the community-acquired MRSA family tree. So that same granddaddy of all Staph aureuses acquired the PVL gene somewhere. Nobody knows where it acquired it from. It may have acquired it from a harmless environmental staphylococcus that isn't Staph aureus, a sort of coagulase-negative staph, which tend to live on skin. And that created the 8081 strain of Staph aureus that I mentioned that was the scourge of the hospitals in the 50s and 60s. And then it disappeared, went away with the use of methicillin and flucloxacillin. And it lurked in the community somewhere. Nobody really knows where. But in the course of time, it picked up the MRSA gene. Nobody knows where from, maybe from another MRSA, maybe from another staphylococcus that had a similar gene. Nobody really knows. But that became the community-acquired MRSA that we're starting to see in the community. And so that's MRSA that produces PVL, and it's related to the 8081 strain that was the problem in the hospitals. If we move on to slide 46, I'm a bit of a misery. I'm a real pessimist. Are we all doomed? Well, undoubtedly, MRSA itself is successful, and that's why we see these epidemic MRSA strains in the hospital. And undoubtedly, PVL seems to be successful, because we're seeing this successful outbreak in the Plymouth area, and there have been outbreaks of community-acquired MRSA across the world. So rather than it being slightly disadvantaged by having to produce the PVL and disappearing again as a medical curiosity, it's appearing more and more. So it's obviously a successful thing for this bug to have. But the ecology of MRSA is always changing. That's how community-acquired MRSA arose by this changing ecology. So we don't know what the future holds, but we do need to be aware of what's going on. And we also need to consider pandemic influenza, which is in the press at the moment. Now, people who have influenza are at risk of post-influenza staphylococcal pneumonia. And it's possible that a lot of the people who died in the 1918 flu pandemic may have died of staphylococcal pneumonia after having had influenza. And that may be why, and it's just maybe, it's all conjecture, but maybe why a lot of the people who died in that pandemic were young, healthy adults. And if you go right back to the start of the presentation when I was talking about necrotizing pneumonia from PVL, the people who tend to die from that are young, healthy adults. So it may be that if there's a flu pandemic in the next few years, that we may see a large increase in deaths from PVL-producing pneumonia, and that may be PVL-producing MRSA causing that pneumonia. Now, that's conjecture, and it might not happen, but as I say, I'm a pessimist, and I do think we need to bear that in mind. So finally, if we move on to slide 47, I did mention that there are some guidelines produced by the Department of Health PVL Working Group. That's the web address there that you can get those guidelines on. As I say, they are interim, but they do mention a little bit about clinical management of PVL Staph aureus. So talking about flucloxacillin and the use of clindamycin, as I mentioned, which is useful in helping to switch off toxin production, and mentioning appropriate antibiotics for use in community-acquired MRSA. It also mentions the current infection control thinking, which is that patients should be screened as you would for MRSA, and decolonization regimens as you would for MRSA should be implicated after infection has been treated. It mentions for necrotizing pneumonia, the infection control issues there. So mentioning that if you're dealing with somebody with a staphylococcal pneumonia, you need to consider using surgical masks during intubation and physiotherapy and invasive procedures such as that, using closed tracheal suction, etc. And also, again, screening both the patient and also close contacts of the patient for carriage of PVL-positive Staph aureus. It also mentions the signs and symptoms that you get with PVL pneumonia, which I mentioned earlier on, and they're all listed there in these guidelines as well. And it also has some references for further reading as well. As I say, the guidelines are interim and they're subject to change. There are some Canadian guidelines which are mentioned there as well, and they're in the CMAJ, and they were published in January 2007. Edition of CMAJ, and it's well worth having a read of those, because it also mentions the history of community-acquired MRSA in Canada, gives some local information. So it's a very interesting article. As I say, I've not managed to do Brenda's slides justice, but if you do have any questions that I can answer, my email address is there, and I'm perfectly happy to answer any questions myself. And if there are any questions that I can pass on to Brenda, I'm sure she'd be only too happy to answer them when she gets the chance.
Thank you very much, Adam. I would just ask you one question. We've started to see a number of cases, both MRSA and MSSA, up here.
Sure.
And again, in young fit individuals, soft tissue injuries. What's the advice with regards to kind of extending screening into families? I certainly take the point that you made about the sort of amount of support that families need.
Sure.
And I've spent many a long hour in recent months sort of talking to families, because they do see it as a completely different entity to MRSA, and I think they're understanding the significance of this.
Mm.
What do you think we should be doing with regarding to extending screening? Screening in families?
Well, certainly in patients with pneumonia, which is an increasing problem across the country, I think it's extremely important that all family members are screened.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding cases of boils, initially we didn't screen family members and didn't eradicate family members, but this is something that down in Devon they have now started to do, and because we found those cases of families where they've been passing it on to one another. So now the current suggestion is, I believe, that any family members who live in the same household are screened and decolonized as well.
Right.
So decolonize them as you would an MRSA contact. But it's just because this bug does seem to have a tendency to pass from one family member to another.
I have to say, our experience is that we found it in the two adult members of the family, but not in the children,
yeah,
thankfully.
Yeah. We have found we had one case where it was the mum and the daughter that were getting recurrent infections, and the dad and the son weren't. Mm. So it doesn't seem to follow any rules.
No.
So it's worth just treating everybody, really.
Oh, it's good to know that we've done the right thing then here, so
yeah,
that's good. Okay, well, thank you again, Adam. So really it just befalls me to say thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank Adam for an excellent presentation. Against all odds, I think, Adam, so well done. I hope to see you all again in the teleclass soon. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.